What if everything you're stressing about as a parent barely matters?
Okay, that's a bold opener. I'm already defensive, and I don't even have kids yet.
Which is exactly why this episode might be the most liberating thing you hear all week. Welcome to Claude Talks. I'm Ryan.
And I'm Emma. And today we are diving into one of the most controversial ideas in all of developmental psychology, the question of how much parents actually shape who their children become.
And I want to be upfront, I find this research genuinely freeing. Emma is going to push back, which is good, because the findings are counterintuitive enough that they deserve serious scrutiny.
Yeah, I'll admit, when Ryan first pitched this episode, my gut reaction was, this sounds like the kind of thing people say to excuse bad parenting. But I've actually been sitting with the research for a few weeks now, and it's more interesting than I expected.
So let's start with the question itself. Parents today are obsessed with every decision. Which school? Which diet? Screen time limits. Whether they raised their voice last Tuesday. Whether they're doing attachment parenting or authoritative parenting or gentle parenting or some combination of all three that they read about at midnight on a parenting subreddit.
Guilty. I've definitely sent those posts to friends. Have you tried this?
We all have. And the implicit assumption behind all of that is, what I do determines who my child becomes. My choices, my behavior, my love, my mistakes, all of it adds up to this finished human being.
Which feels right. Feels obviously true. You raise a child, you shape them.
Except the research says, kind of, but way less than you think, and in a different way than you think. And the person who blew this open, really cracked the whole field open, was a woman named Judith Rich Harris.
Tell me about her, because her story is almost as interesting as her thesis.
It really is. So Judith Rich Harris was not a tenured professor. She was not affiliated with a major research institution. She was a textbook author, she'd written psychology textbooks for years, and she was writing a chapter on child development when she basically had a revelation while reviewing the research literature.
What kind of revelation?
The kind where you realize that the consensus view, that parents are the primary shapers of child personality, is not actually well supported by the data. And she wrote this up as a paper, and it was rejected multiple times, and then in 1995 she managed to get it published in Psychological Review, one of the top journals in the field. And then in 1998 she turned it into a book called The Nurture Assumption.
And people lost their minds.
Completely lost their minds. She got hate mail. Developmental psychologists were furious. Here was this outsider, no PhD, no lab, no institutional affiliation, saying that their entire field had been asking the wrong questions.
So what was she actually arguing?
Her core thesis is this: peers matter more than parents for personality development. Not for everything, we'll get to the nuances, but for the adult personality traits you end up with, your peer group during childhood and adolescence has more influence than your parents do.
Okay, that's the part where my skepticism kicks in. Because how do you even measure that? How do you separate peer influence from parent influence, when the parents also chose where to live, which school to send you to, which neighborhood you grow up in?
That is exactly the right question, and the answer comes from behavioral genetics. Specifically from twin studies and adoption studies. And this is where it gets really interesting.
Walk me through the twin studies.
So the classic setup is this: you compare identical twins who were raised together versus identical twins who were raised apart, separated at birth, adopted by different families. The question is, how similar are they as adults?
And the answer?
Startlingly similar. Even twins raised in completely different families, with different parents, different environments, different schools, their adult personalities, their IQ scores, their risk of mental illness, all of these show very high similarity. Sometimes almost as high as twins raised together.
So genes are doing a lot of the work.
Genes are doing a huge amount of the work. Behavioral geneticists estimate that roughly 50% of personality variance is heritable. Half of why you are the way you are comes down to your genetic inheritance.
Okay, but that still leaves 50%. And you'd assume the other 50% is the environment, which includes parenting.
Here's where it gets counterintuitive. Behavioral geneticists partition the environment into two components. Shared environment, that's the stuff siblings share, same parents, same home, same neighborhood. And non-shared environment, the stuff that's unique to each individual, different friend groups, different classrooms, different experiences, different random events in their lives.
And the shared environment, that's basically parenting, right? Same parents, same household, that's what you're measuring.
Largely, yes. And the finding, which has been replicated dozens of times across different countries and different traits, is that the shared environment has a surprisingly small effect on adult personality. Often close to zero.
Wait, close to zero? That can't be right.
I know. It sounds wrong. It sounds almost offensive. But think about siblings. They have the same parents, the same home, roughly the same upbringing, and yet they often turn out to be very different people. The shared environment isn't doing what we assumed it was doing.
So if shared environment is near zero and genes account for 50%, what's the other 50%?
Non-shared environment. The stuff that's not your parents, your peer group, your teachers, chance encounters, the particular experiences that are yours and not your siblings. And a lot of that non-shared environment, Harris argued, is driven by peers.
And then there's the adoption studies, which are equally striking.
Yes. Studies on adopted children show that by adulthood, they resemble their biological parents, whom they never grew up with, more than their adoptive parents in personality traits and in IQ. Which is a pretty remarkable finding. The family that raised them, gave them everything, loved them, in terms of adult personality, they resemble those parents less than the parents they never met.
Okay, I've spent the last few weeks resisting this, and I have to say, the evidence is hard to dismiss. But I want to make sure we're not taking it too far, because I think there's a version of this that people hear and conclude, well, parenting doesn't matter at all, so why bother?
And that's the misreading Harris was most frustrated by. She was not saying parents don't matter. She was saying parents matter in specific ways that are different from what we assumed. Let's talk about what parents actually do and don't influence.
Let's do that.
So what do parents genuinely shape? Values. Religion. Language. Cultural identity. Specific skills and interests. If you're raised in a musical household, you're more likely to play music. Attachment security, the early bond between parent and child absolutely matters. Emotional baseline and co-regulation in the early years, when the nervous system is still developing and children literally learn to regulate their emotions through the interactions they have with caregivers.
So all of that is real and important.
All of that is real and important. What parents seem to have much less influence over, adult personality traits like conscientiousness, agreeableness, extroversion. IQ, beyond extreme environments. Who your child chooses as friends at school. And crucially, how your child behaves outside the home.
That last one is interesting. Say more.
Harris has this idea of children having two selves. There's the home self, the child you know, the one who behaves in certain ways with you, who follows the rules you've set, who reflects the culture of your household. And then there's the peer self, the version of your child that exists at school, in the playground, with friends. That peer self is largely shaped by the peer group, not by you.
And those two selves don't necessarily converge.
They can be quite different. And that's not a failure of parenting, it's actually developmentally normal. Children learn to code switch between environments. The things that make you popular with your peer group are different from the things that make you a good son or daughter. Children figure that out on their own.
There's a phrase that keeps coming to me. The child you raise is not the adult they become.
Yes. And I think that's actually freeing once you sit with it. The adult your child becomes is shaped by their genes, by their peer experiences, by their own choices and trajectories, not just by what you did or didn't do. You are not the sole author of that story.
I want to talk about genes more because I think there's a subtlety here that gets missed. It's not just genes do 50%, environment does 50%, parenting does some share of that 50%. There's also this concept of gene-environment correlation, which complicates the picture significantly.
Right. This is where it gets really interesting for parenting specifically. Take a classic example: parents who read a lot tend to have children who read a lot. If you run a study on this, you find a correlation between parenting behavior, reading aloud, having books in the house, and the child's reading ability.
And the obvious interpretation is, good parenting. The parents modeled reading, the child picked it up.
Except you can't separate it from genetics. Parents who love reading probably have genes that predispose them to enjoy reading. Those same genes get passed to their children. So when the kid loves books, is that because of the parenting behavior, or because of the genetic inheritance? Or both?
And the answer is probably both, but the genetics contribution is larger than we assumed.
Much larger. This is called passive gene-environment correlation. The child passively inherits both genes and an environment that are correlated, because they come from the same parents.
And there are other types.
There's evocative gene-environment correlation. A child's genetically influenced traits evoke particular responses from their environment. A child who's naturally sociable gets invited to more playdates, gets more social experience, which reinforces and develops that sociability. The parent didn't engineer that. The child's own nature drew those experiences toward them.
And then active, which is the most powerful in older children.
Active gene-environment correlation. As children get older, they increasingly choose their own environments. A child who's genetically predisposed toward music seeks out music. A child who's aggressive seeks out peer groups where aggression is normalized. They're selecting the niches that fit their nature. And parents have less and less control over this as the child develops.
Which is why the parenting effect looks smaller in adults than in children. Because over time, the child's own nature increasingly takes over the steering wheel.
Exactly. And this is also why most parenting research is methodologically flawed. If you do a study that finds a correlation between warm parenting and well-adjusted children, you can't conclude that the warm parenting caused the well-adjusted children, because you haven't controlled for the fact that warmer parents might also be passing on genes that make children easier to regulate and more well-adjusted.
You'd need adoption studies or twin studies to disentangle that.
And most parenting research doesn't use those designs. Which means the literature has systematically overstated parenting effects for decades.
Okay, so what do we do with all of this? If you're a parent listening to this right now, what's the practical takeaway?
The first takeaway is, you are probably not ruining your child every time you're not perfect. The anxiety that a bad day means permanent damage, that if you lost your temper this morning you've set back their development, is not supported by the evidence. Children are resilient. Their outcomes are not a fragile function of your every move.
Which is the liberation part. And I do feel that, even as someone without kids, the pressure on modern parents is extraordinary. They're expected to be perfectly attuned at all times, perfectly patient, perfectly stimulating, perfectly consistent.
And that pressure doesn't make better parents, it makes more anxious parents. And anxious parents aren't great for kids either.
But, and this is important, the research doesn't say anything goes. Extreme environments absolutely matter.
Completely. This is the crucial caveat. Abuse, neglect, severe poverty, chronic instability, these do affect outcomes. The evidence is clear on that. We're not talking about whether trauma matters. We're talking about the variation within the range of ordinary, reasonably good parenting.
The difference between a perfectly optimized parent and a good enough parent.
Right. And the research suggests that within that range, from good enough to excellent, the variation in outcomes is much smaller than we'd expect. Whether you sent them to the slightly better school, whether you chose the organic food, whether you did the perfect Montessori response at 3 in the morning, these choices are probably not the variables that determine who your child becomes.
Which brings me to Winnicott, the British pediatrician and psychoanalyst who coined the phrase good enough parent. He was making a very similar point decades before the behavioral genetics research.
Winnicott's argument was that children don't need perfect parents. They need parents who are reliably present, reliably warm, and reliably available. The occasional failure, the rupture, and repair, that's not harmful. It might even be beneficial, because children learn to cope with disappointment and reconnect.
There's something really important in that word reliable. Not perfect. Reliable.
consistent enough that the child has a secure base. The attachment bond, this is the thing that does seem to matter in the long run. Not whether you got every decision right, but whether the child fundamentally feels safe, loved, and seen.
So what is worth investing in your view?
Emotional warmth in the relationship. Full stop. That's the thing the research keeps pointing back to. Not the specific techniques, not the particular parenting style, but whether your child genuinely feels loved and secure with you. That matters.
What else?
Exposing kids to diverse experiences and opportunities. Not because you're engineering specific outcomes, but because you're widening the menu. If they have the opportunity to try music and sport and art and coding and time in nature, they're more likely to find the things that fit their nature.
Being a stable base emotionally, practically.
Yes. And modeling your values. Here's a nuance that matters. Even if you don't shape your child's personality, you do shape their values. Children who grow up in households that value education, service, honesty, those values tend to transmit. Not through lectures, but through watching what you actually do with your life.
The values piece is interesting because it cuts against the simple reading of parenting doesn't matter. It's more like, parenting doesn't determine the kind of person they'll be in terms of core personality, but it does shape the lens through which they interpret the world and what they care about.
Beautifully put. And that's not nothing. The moral and cultural and spiritual framework you offer, that's a genuine legacy.
I want to come back to Harris for a moment because I think it's worth acknowledging how she was received over time. Initially, the backlash was ferocious. But what happened in the years after?
The behavioral genetics evidence kept accumulating and kept pointing in the same direction. More twin studies, bigger adoption studies, more sophisticated genetic analyses, all of them consistently showing that shared environment effects on adult personality are small. The field didn't exactly apologize to Harris, but the consensus quietly shifted. The data vindicated her thesis even if her personality rubbed people the wrong way.
She won the George A. Miller Award from the American Psychological Association in 1997, the year before the nurture assumption came out, which was actually a recognition of her 1995 paper. So even before the book-level controversy, the work was being recognized within the field.
Right. And she kept writing and updating her ideas until her death in 2018. She never backed down from the core thesis, but she refined it, particularly the mechanisms around peer groups and how children identify with groups and take on the norms of those groups.
She's a fascinating figure. An outsider who was right about something important, in a way that threatened insiders. That's not a comfortable position to be in.
And I think the reason it was so threatening is obvious. Parenting is deeply personal. If you've dedicated your life to raising children well, being told that the variation in how you did it probably didn't change the outcome much, that's existentially threatening.
It can feel like it devalues the work of parenting.
But I'd argue the opposite. It devalues the performance of parenting, the anxious optimization, the competitive parenting, the helicopter behaviors. What it values is the relationship itself. The love, the presence, the warmth, not as tools for producing a better outcome adult, but as intrinsically worthwhile.
Your kid doesn't need you to be their life coach. They need you to be their parent, to love them without conditions attached to how they turn out.
And that's actually a more demanding thing, in a weird way. It's harder to love someone for who they are than to love a project.
That's beautifully uncomfortable.
The best things usually are.
Okay, let's bring this home. If you had to summarize what we've covered today in a few sentences, what would you say?
The research is clear that genes matter more than we assumed, and parenting matters less, specifically in terms of shaping adult personality traits, IQ, and who your child becomes independent of the relationship with you. Peers matter more than parents for personality development. And within the range of good enough to excellent parenting, the variation in outcomes is smaller than the modern parenting anxiety industrial complex would have you believe.
But.
Extreme environments, abuse, neglect, chronic deprivation, do harm children. The attachment bond matters. Emotional warmth matters. Values transmit. Early emotional experiences shape the nervous system in real ways. And the relationship you have with your child, the love, the security, the feeling of being known, that matters enormously, even if it doesn't show up as a data point in a personality inventory.
I came into this episode as a skeptic. I leave it feeling genuinely less anxious about the idea of being a parent one day, like the pressure that I absorbed from culture, that if I don't do everything perfectly I'll damage someone. That's not what the science says.
The science says, be warm. Be present. Be reliable. Provide experiences. Model what you value. And then let your child be the person their nature is pushing them to become. You're the stable base, not the architect.
The stable base, not the architect. I love that.
That's the show. Thanks for being here for this one. It's one of those episodes where I hope it genuinely lands for people who need it. If you're a parent who's been grinding themselves down over every imperfect moment, I hope this gives you a bit of permission to breathe.
And if you want to go deeper, read The Nurture Assumption by Judith Rich Harris. It's 25 years old now, but it reads like it was written yesterday, and it will change how you think about this.
Until next time.
Take care of yourselves and maybe be a little kinder to yourselves as parents too.